Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. I'm the Rosetta Stone of healthcare. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. Careful what you wish for. Health equity and participatory medicine depend on the widespread, meaningful use of patient family advisors. The trickle of such advisors should be a stream. Unfortunately, even if the supply could meet demand, healthcare administrators, researchers, entrepreneurs lack skill in making good use of patient family advisors. Libby Hoy leads Patient Family Centered Care Partners, a small organization with a large vision for improving the quality, safety, and experience of healthcare through the development of authentic partnerships from the bedside caregiving relationship to the boardroom. PFCC Partners is committed to collaborating with patients, families, physicians, healthcare administrators, nurses, therapists, social workers, and all those invested in improving healthcare. From one force of nature to another, I'm honored to speak with my hero, Libby Hoy. We started the conversation with Libby introducing herself.
I usually introduce myself as a mom of three grown young men living with mitochondrial disease. I am a patient family advisor from that experience, as well as my own lived experience with stage 3 salivary gland cancer. And through that perspective, I feel strongly about the value of partnership and partnership with patients and families and healthcare stakeholders across the board to co-design the health system that we all need, that works for patients and families, that works for the payers, the administrators, and importantly, the clinicians. And I think that partnership is the way forward in creating that health system.
So Patient and Family-Centered Care Partners is an aggregation of people who are serving as care partners across the continuum, mostly inpatient. What's the range?
So PFCC Partners is an organization that actually contracts with many health systems, federal contractors, measure developers, research teams to implement the strategy of patient family engagement. So we really see patient family engagement as an active strategy for building a person family-centered health system. And through our work with our partners, we were able to start the Patient Family Advisory Network, which is what you're referring to.
Okay.
So the PFA Network is a program of PFCC Partners.
Okay.
And that is, as you said, the community of over 600 patient and family advisors who are currently partnering in all of those areas. So within hospitals and ambulatory centers, specialty centers, research teams, more recently measurement teams, and even some newer partnerships with payers. So it's a community that is learning together. It's, you know, essentially for advisors by advisors. And one distinction I think is important to kind of keep in mind is how we sort of look at the difference between an advocate, a patient advocate, and a patient family advisor.
Okay.
And I think that's really important because I think the roles are distinct. And though they overlap and support one another, both are critically needed. And so I think acknowledging the differences is really important in that way. We see a patient advocate as someone who's really shining the light on our gaps in care, our gaps and our opportunities for improvement. So they very much are coming to say, hey, we should be at zero hospital-acquired infections. And this is why, and this is my family's story as to why this is important to me and how critical those voices have been and continue to be in the system. The advisor, on the other hand, is more of a partner in co-designing the solution. So less coming at the partnership with the concept of we need to reduce hospital-acquired infections to zero, which of course we do, and we're all in support of that. More so, it's partnering at the local level with our local health systems to say, how are we going to tackle this problem together? That's the goal. We all want to get there. What can we design together that will be better and beneficial for our patient population, our clinician population?
I like that distinction. One of them, you said, shining a light, stories that build emotion, build motivation, and the other, what are we going to do? What are the nuts and bolts of really making it happen in real life, whether it's life flow or workflow?
Exactly. The other word that I often use for advocates is they bring that sense of urgency, right? We need to do this now. We need to do this today. And the advisor comes in to figure out exactly how does it happen within the flow locally. And that's the opportunity too, is to have a hospital or a health center in Mississippi speaking with their patient population and have one in LA County speaking with the Department of Health Services LA County population. Mm-hmm. Those are different populations, right? So it's not a one size fits all solution, but rather that's the opportunity to co-design solutions more locally.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. That's a great frame. How did you come to establish PFCC Partners?
So I started when my kids were little, I started on a parent advisory board and I made all the mistakes, all ineffective. I mean, we were thrilled if we got to comment on the paint color on the wall. And, through many years of...
I can so relate.
Yeah, right? I was excited about
that. How many minutes was I ineffective? I would say... Yes.
In another lifetime, I would love to start Failure University because I have just so much content. Anyway, so I had learned a lot and, what's knowledge if you're not sharing it? So I really wanted the opportunity to connect. And then I actually presented at the Institute for Patient Family Center Care International Conference back in 2006. And there were about 850 participants and there were only 37 from California. And half of those were from Stanford. So it really wasn't happening on the West Coast as much as I wanted to see. Mm. And so I started a conference and asked people if they were interested in a network, and they were. So my very generous in-laws gave me $500 for my 40th birthday, and I bought a business license and a box of cards, and there we went.
Wow. So how do you recognize success in this work?
That's a great question, isn't it? I would say success for me is hearing back from our healthcare partners. What do the patients and families think of this? Let's run it by them. To me, that's when we're really woven into the fabric. I think that's my first line, and when I hear it, I get super excited and super motivated. Mm-hmm. Other success points that I think we haven't quite gotten to yet are when patient family engagement and meaningful engagement is really prepared for and is integrated as an additional voice at the table in a much more robust way. And that's going to include in the budgets. And so
yes,
I don't think we've gotten there quite yet. I think hospitals and healthcare systems struggle a little bit, but they do, typically come up with some funding for advisory councils and whatnot. Not a lot, but some. I think in our federal programs, there's more room to do that. I think in our improvement organizations, having those budgets released a little bit to be able to support that engagement. If the old adage is true, put your money where your mouth is, then when patient family engagement is really written into budgets, I think that will be hardwired into the system.
That's big. I think I'm remembering back to the first, well, it was called a member advisory panel that I established. I was a director of quality management for a behavioral health managed care company.
Ooh.
And I had this awkward moment with my boss about 3 months after I was hired, where he asked me, so how do you think we're doing? And I said, well, I don't think we're moving as fast along as you want us to. And he said, well, what should we do? And I said, well, frankly, we need to start with you. And I thought, oh my goodness, that was a career-ending statement. But he rose to it and said, okay, 7:30 every morning, I'm in town. You have a half an hour of my time, your agenda. And it was so empowering.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
And so the first thing that actually we talked about is that we needed to hear from members and clinicians. And so his first act was to charge me to establish a member advisory panel and a clinician advisory panel. But what was unique, and then it was like, oh my God, what do I do? You know, and I was like, you know, a little freaked out. But what was different that I learned afterwards is that he directed the leadership team, which I was part of, to hear what was learned and to do something about it. So he engaged himself. And then I found in my subsequent roles of similar nature across the continuum is that was really unusual, that it was mostly lip service, if it occurred at all. And it was more show and tell than what do we, you know, redesign.
Right, right.
What I really am intrigued about now that I'm sitting in on some of the work that your organization is doing as a, you know, I'm on that opioid task force, and is that just like clinicians, we so vary in our ability to be good expert advisors. And that I feel like what's happening, like, so I've been on two calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like what you and other members are doing is there's a subtle, it's the subject, but there's also this subtle coaching in terms of how do you think, asking questions that move the conversation forward in a non-threatening manner. And I think that lay people are no better than professional people at that. And
well,
so in a way that's part of, you know, being a CEO of your health is advocacy, manage, lead, learn, decide. So say something about that.
I think you're hitting the nail on the head. I think that's one of the opportunities that we have in front of us. There's basically three purposes for the PFA network, and one of them is capacity raising or skills development. Human beings, professionals or otherwise, have differing levels of capacity. So how do we support one another as a community to develop those skills and to, you know, really strengthen partnerships? And we have a very solid core in the core competencies of effective partnerships, which were created by the PFA network members. So we asked people, when you're really being effective, when you're in that room and you feel like you're moving that conversation forward, you're asking the right questions or open-ended questions, or you're responding in a way that people can hear and be learned from. I mean, how many rooms have we been in where, you know, somebody has a great point and all the passion in the world, but because of the delivery, loses the opportunity to create message. So how do we really hone those skills and be able to be effective partners and move our partners? We've got those core competencies to guide us, but that's why we're doing a lot of the preparation activities and skills exchange. And it's not that FCC partners or my team has all the answers. The answers lie in the community. All we're doing is culling the knowledge and the effective strategies and then turning them back out to newer advisors and really raising the capacity overall.
Communication is a two-way street. And there's also, on the other side, there's the skill in listening.
Mm-hmm.
I spent some time as vice president for quality management in an organization, Advocates Inc.
Mm-hmm.
And Advocates Inc. supports about 23,000 people with disabilities. And one of the things that they do amazingly well is there are people that they support at every level of the organization, from the board on down. And as you can imagine, the people who sit on the different levels of, you know, whether it's the board or design or operations, they have varying skills in speaking, in getting their points across. But what Advocates is pretty amazing at is listening to that, which maybe I wasn't that good at when I started there. Frankly, I wasn't that good at it when I started there. They were able to call the value in what people were saying that might not seem artful in a formal gathering, a business gathering, yet it had value. So it's both the ability to be an advisor and at it, and it's the ability to listen and hear. So
I think,
do you guys work both ends of it?
Absolutely. I think it's critical to be a strong, high-value advisor. You have to, you know, we hear some terms around meet people where they are, and it's so true. In order to do that, you have to listen first. And, you know, when my boys were young and we were racing back and forth and to new positions, it took us a 7-year nationwide search to get them properly diagnosed. And I remember our pediatrician saying, with every new physician you meet, with every new clinician you meet, make sure they ask you what you've done before they tell you what to do. And I thought,
no, that's good. That's good.
That's so simple.
Yeah.
But so honestly, Danny, that's kind of become my mantra and our organization's mantra. Ask people how they've tried to solve the problems of readmissions before you come in telling them what to do. Always ask first and hear and value what people have put into a given issue before you arrived. I don't think any of us on either side of the table have the silver bullet to fix these problems. They were developed over time in a lot of complexity. They're going to be unraveled over time with a lot of complexity. So I think the foundation of the core competencies is to establish partnerships. That's on me as an advisor to come to that relationship as a full partner, which means ask them what they've done before you tell them what to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, wow. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's shift to now the individual. You have your own health challenges, your kids have health challenges. So how did you evolve first? How did you evolve to becoming CEO of your own health?
That's such an enormous question, and we could spend hours with that, right? But I will say that I started in a place of fear, and I started in a place of shock. I wasn't expecting, when my second son was born, he was immediately in trouble, turned blue, and was whisked away from me. And so there was shock. There was being dropped into this world I didn't understand or know anything about. And so it arose from, I think, an instinctual mama bear area to, okay, I need to jump in here somewhere. And it wasn't easy, especially in the early periods. I trusted all of the medical clinicians much more than I trusted myself with the kids, and bringing them home on all kinds of equipment and, you know, not feeling confident. And it was 18 months almost to the day before I held my son without something attached. And that was a long, long time. So
yeah,
it's this confidence wave. But then the more you do things and the more that you, I think the more that I was inquisitive and teachable in terms of what I needed to learn to be effective in their care, to feel confident, mm-hmm. the more that I got that back, the more I got from our clinicians, you can do this. You can change a PICC line dressing. You can do tube feedings. You're building these skills. Consistent encouragement, I think, was fed by my own inquisitiveness. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were moments of doubt, complete mm-hmm. doubt, and completely overwhelmed. Continuing to move forward. The other thing that really helped me, and I'm still such a huge proponent of documenting what happened. I used to have these huge notebooks for each of the boys that I would carry to each appointment. It had sections for each specialist and the therapists. And so it was all sort of in one place, my own EHR, but paper and binder. And having that all there cleared my own head. And when I was diagnosed with cancer in 2016, I went back to that. Like, I know I can't manage all of this here. Mm-hmm. I've got to get it out. So capturing all of that in whatever organizational way you do mm-hmm. empowers you to not feel like you have to have it all in your head, but you are informed, you are keeping up. And so I think that was one of the biggest ways to manage the enormity of the situation.
How did it evolve that as your boys got older, that they took part more and more in their own management and decision making?
That's an interesting question as well. And that was actually influenced by the fact that they weren't diagnosed. So things were not looking good. And yet we didn't know that things were not going to eventually look good or what have you. And so it was always in the back of our minds, my husband and I, you know, we're going to raise them as we had planned to raise them. We're just going to do this other thing as well. So they, you know, were disciplined and they had expectations. And even from a very young age, they were included into the conversation. So at 2 years old, where do you want your IV started? And, you know, we'd go here and here. And that evolved. I'm just thinking of Stephen. I'll take him all the way through. So that evolved to, you know, at 7 and 8, I really can't stand the tape you're using with my IV. Would you, if you'll just tape it, you know, because on a child, they usually overdo. Because
yes.
And so he would make bargains with his nurses. If you would just tape, you know, one or two strips here, I promise I won't touch it. And he engaged, right? And then that became.
Oh, that's great. I love that story. Yeah.
So I think from a very young age, the expectation was set that they would have voice in the system. At first, me making space for their voice, and ultimately their care team and themselves making space. And then I remember as a teenager, Stephen asking his GI doctor, why can't I go snowboarding with a PICC line in? Mm-hmm. And the GI doctor looked at him like, I've never been asked that question before. And so they worked through it. Here's the risks. You may dislodge it, and then you're going to have it replaced. And he decided he wanted to take that risk. And so they worked it all out. But mm-hmm. from an early age, it, you know, even the simplest pieces of control for a young child or even a young person and young in their diagnosis can be very, very effective mm-hmm. in wow. building that capacity. Yeah.
So learning by doing. Mm-hmm. That just seems, that's so common sense. There's such a range, you yeah. know, just like, the, you know, what we were just talking about, the, you know, whether it's the organization or the activist, the advisor, there's such a range of Absolutely. Competence and capabilities. And I guess the goal is to align as much as possible and grow, which is what you were saying at the beginning, which was partnerships. Mm-hmm. So really the individual and the community are kind of similar.
So we have an interesting way of looking at that. We okay. feel strongly, we look at almost like two sides of the scale, right? Okay. Engaging in my own care or in my children's care is something that happens within the clinical context. And happens between the physician and the, or the clinician and the individual. It requires that good communication. We know a lot about what that engagement looks like. But here's the thing, that also requires policy behind it that provides the physician enough time to have those conversations. It requires systems set up so that bedside rounding occurs and we are all informed. So that engagement has to have this other piece of it that is organizational design and improvement. And so that's the advisor role. So in our mind, one without the other is unsustainable. If we don't have the policies that support this, it falls apart. And similarly, if we have advisory councils, but they're not ultimately impacting the clinical environment so that every patient and every family member has the opportunity to engage, then that's not sustainable. So we see them very, very much connected and needed in both areas. So my mom-in-law was in a very well-known health system following a stroke a few years ago. And we were all around. Of course, I was really impressed with the nurses and the clinical staff and really engaging my in-laws in the conversation, engaging us in the conversation. And we were getting closer to discharge. And I said, you know, could we look at a list of the medications? Because grandma had been on a couple that worked really well and a couple that didn't work really well. And we wanted to make sure, you know, we knew which ones were which. And I wanted to start helping grandpa get used to the medications and what was going on. And so our nurse said, oh, of course. And she'd been so engaging the whole time. So she said, oh, of course, let me just run up to the nurse's station and get it. And she came back and said, I was just reminded that our policy is we can't give the medication list until you go home, until discharge. And I said, you realize that's not congruent with the whole hospital stay, right? We've been working together this whole time and it's not going to help, you know, it's not going to help us prepare. And she said, I know, I totally get it. It's just our policy. We can't do it. I said, okay. And she said, here's the computer, the on the wheels. She said, I suddenly have to go to the bathroom. I'm going to leave this right here and I'll be right back. And she very sweetly left so that we could copy the medication list. And I just thought, why are we doing this to our staff? Why this individual wanted, was encouraged, was taught by the organization to engage patients and families and came up against a policy that didn't allow her to do that and didn't have the autonomy to override that system. So, you know, that was kind of a light bulb moment for me that, yeah, we can't pick a side and only focus on one. We have to do both.
Yeah. And when you look at complex organizations of complex systems and inevitable failure in complex systems, the way you minimize failures is to allow for sensible workarounds.
Yes.
And here was a place where she did a sensible workaround, but it was sort of like, I don't know, I'm being opinionated here. It seems like it was wasted. Not wasted, but that she had that kind of creativity. It was unnecessary to exercise that creativity muscle at that moment.
There. Yeah.
It was like, that's just crazy making story.
I early on, I think maybe it was the early 90s, I remember doing a presentation to hospital administration and saying, you know, isn't this great? Your patients and families can show you things that you don't see in your own organization because you don't have that lens. And like, for instance, all the workarounds that are going on the second floor. I mean, I can tell you all the ways your staff are working around and it seems so stupid now, but not surprising, they were less than excited about my presentation. I thought it was really being helpful, but turns out I didn't really see the context.
Now a word from our sponsor, Abridge. Pediatrics, geriatrics, primary care, physical therapy. Use Abridge. Push the big pink button and record the conversation with your healthcare professional. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. A bridge was created by patients, doctors, and caregivers. Check out the app at abridge.com, ABRIDGE.com, or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went. Libby and I next shifted from discussing decision-making with children to decision-making with older folk, pediatrics to geriatrics. I asked Libby if she could apply the same principles to both populations.
It's a great question, as all your questions are. I feel like it's two ends of the same spectrum. So we're doing quite a bit of work with the National Institute of Aging on a few different research projects and really embracing the whole geriatric space, especially with when it comes to research. And what I'm finding is the geriatricians in that space so much remind me of the pediatricians. They have this natural understanding that you're going to have to work with the family as a unit, that it's not an individual. And I don't know why we wait for either end of the life spectrum for that. Really should be available to every patient and family member. But in any case, so I do see it as two ends of the spectrum. One of the things I always kept in my mind when the kids were little was preserve their natural progression, their natural development as to the extent possible at all times. So every decision was looked at through that lens of, you know, is this going to limit their natural development? If so, are the trade-offs there? Is it worth it to do that or to risk their natural development? And I kind of see it the same thing with the older populations. Is it preserving their life trajectory, right? Which includes death. It's the way all of us are going to leave here. So are we preserving that natural human development to the degree that that individual wants it? And so I think, you know, it's, you bring up such a good point. We're still not to the point quite yet of talking about end of life freely and unawkwardly. I don't even know if that's a word. But the more that we can move the culture to considering that, I think the better opportunity we have to preserve that natural human development. So I do see it kind of as that same, you know, how it gets expressed in the geriatric population may be a little bit different, but the need for family, however you define that, is there, and the natural development should be preserved, I think.
I'm trying to work that through in thinking about how I could have been more effective in moving my parents along in this being CEO of their health process. Now, having said that, it didn't really matter what I thought. You know, my opinion about what they should do, but, you know, that and a buck and a quarter would have bought you a Pepsi. And, you know, and it was like, it's sort of, who cares what I thought they should do? They weren't ready.
Right.
And there's, I know that sometimes I've thought with my kids, well, they're not ready. And so a decision might be I would give them two choices that were both acceptable to me and then let them decide. Mm-hmm. And then we got to the stage where I thought that was a crazy decision that they were making. And now what am I going to do with that?
Right.
You know, I want them to be making decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I'm trying to think of an example and I can't, but it wasn't like, you know, run across a busy street without looking. It was a decision that just didn't make sense to me.
I wonder if it's helpful to think about, especially with parents, and I lost my mom young, so I didn't get this chance with her too much, although we did talk end of life before she passed. I wonder if it's helpful to think about, and this was always my mom's way of approaching life was process over product. Pay attention to what's available. Pay attention to what's going on, and don't worry so much about the outcome. So I think sometimes the five wishes and all of these wonderful templates that we have push people too fast, too soon, when it's not an isolated conversation.
Yes.
It's more of a, you know, so I imagine when you're parenting your kids, you're providing guidance all along, and then you're hoping that those decisions get, you know, put onto the framework of all that you've taught. You're not just turning them loose on the world at 16, mm-hmm. hoping they figured it out, you know. So I think when we really pay attention to the process and the conversations that and relationship that leads up to those, I think that can be really helpful in getting us both to where we have a mutual understanding. And don't get me wrong, I think Five Wishes is a fantastic conversation starter, and the Conversation Project, we've got lots of great tools to help us have those conversations. But we still have to have those conversations and have that framework in the context of the individual's life.
I kept coming back to the intertwined cords of patient family advice and policy practice change. One without the other seems disheartening and, frankly, a waste of precious time. Libby and I returned to the core competencies of PFCC partners.
So at the top of our core competencies is the teachable spirit.
Okay, say more.
The teachable spirit is a term that came to us from a gentleman named Kai, who was an advisor, and came to one of our skills exchange, one of our early skills exchange. And he sat in the back of the room with a bunch of people who were very boisterous, and he sat very quietly. And at the end of the 4 hours, he said, you know, this all comes down to, you know, committing to entering this partnership with a teachable spirit. And when I asked him to explain, he said, you know, we as advisors have to come to this partnership knowing there's lots we don't know about running a healthcare system or being a clinician, but there might also be something that those organizations don't know about being a patient in that organization. And so when we commit to a teachable spirit, we're really committing to the fact that what we build together will be far greater than what either of us could have done apart. So that's exactly, I think, what you're looking for. That's what we look for in partners, is a teachable spirit.
So, you know, we're back to the beginning, which is which is how have you tried to become more patient engaged already? You know, asking that, I mean, I'm putting it a little differently than we talked about it when we started, but it's instead of my ideas about what they should do, it's what have you done so far and how has that worked? Might be a good approach.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, because that's a primary activity of having a teachable spirit, right?
Yeah.
And that's you emulating what you want to see in this partnership if you're going to move forward with it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me. I look forward to seeing you in, what, a week?
Yes. So fast.
The audience of my Health Hats activism are people who help other people. Advocates, advisors, policymakers, informaticists, researchers, clinicians, caregivers, case managers, and more. People who help other people make their way in our healthcare system for best health. The gist of my mission is learning to make choices, learning to communicate with each other, learning to support each other, learning to share what works. At the heart of my mission is health equity, equal opportunity for best health. All of this rests on the catalytic relationship with people who use the healthcare system and those who manage it, study it, pay for it, control it. Libby Hoy's Patient Family-Centered Care Partners delivers key services to advance the number and effectiveness of those relationships. Thank you for this important work. follow my blog, podcasts, and resources through my website. See you around the block.